Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools. We're here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education and also to promote the ideas of separation of religion from the state. We're not against religion and we're not against private schools. We just don't think that they should be on the public treasury teat, which they certainly are at the moment. And our press release 1053, Keep the Church and State Forever Separate, a USA House resolution recalls a 150-year-old speech, is about the separation of church and state, not just in Australia, but in America. So over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1053. Keep the Church and State Forever Separate. USA House Resolution recalls a 150-year-old speech. On the 30th of September 2025, US Reps Yasemin Ansari, Democrat Arizona, Jared Huffman, Democrat California, and Jamie Raskin, Democrat Maryland, members of the Congressional Free Thought Caucus, introduced a resolution in Congress honouring separation of church and state and noting the key role it has played in safeguarding religious freedom in America. The resolution's eloquent language stands in stark contrast to the ongoing antics of President Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission, which continues to be driven by Christian nationalist organisations bent on undermining the wall of separation between church and state. Two key speeches. Among other historical references, the resolution highlights two key speeches supporting church-state separation by American political leaders. John F. Kennedy's September 12, 1960 speech to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association and a speech by President Ulysses S. Grant on September 29, 1875. Both endorsed church-state separation during their remarks. Kennedy famously said, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him." The Kennedy speech is well known, but what about Grant's remarks? What led him to deliver a statement calling for separation between church and state while addressing a meeting of Union Army veterans in Des Moines? Schools marred by sectarian division. At the time Grant delivered those remarks, public schools in the United States, often called common schools back then, were growing rapidly. But the schools were often marked by sectarian division. Many public schools were de facto Protestant in character and hosted Protestant prayers and readings from the King James Version of the Bible every school day. Catholic immigration in the United States had been on the upswing for years. Catholic parents naturally chafed at having their children compelled to take part in Protestant activities in public schools. Their answer was not to remove the prayers, but to demand public funding for their own private religious schools. Grant biographer Jean Edward Smith noted that Grant decided to use the speech to give both Protestants and Catholics a stern lecture on religious tolerance and the separation of church and state. It's unclear why Grant chose this particular venue to deliver the speech, but it seems that the matter had been weighing on his mind. Smith calls the speech the most emotional of his career. The Grant solution. Grant's solution was twofold: a system of free public schools that were secular in nature and no taxpayer aid to religious schools. Encourage free schools and resolve that not $1 of money appropriated to their support, no matter how raised, shall be appropriated to the support of any sectarian school, Grant proposed. Resolve that either the state or nation, or both combined, shall support institutions of learning sufficient to afford to every child growing up in the land the opportunity of a good common school education, unmixed with sectarian, pagan, or atheistical tenets. Leave the matter of religion to the family circle, the church, and the private school, supported entirely by private contribution. Keep the church and state forever separate. It was a great solution, and it was eventually adopted in America. Even before Grant's speech, state Supreme Courts had begun removing coercive school-sponsored prayer and Bible readings from public schools, a stance the US Supreme adopted in 1962 and 1963. The Supreme Court, in a string of cases from the 1960s and 70s, also curbed direct taxpayer support for religious schools. A vision denied. Unfortunately, Grant's vision did not endure. In 2002, the Supreme Court upheld private school vouchers, opening the floodgates of public support for religious education. And the secular nature of public schools, whilst it holds now, is under constant assault by Christian nationalists. Grant had his faults, but his concept of church-state separation was solid and visionary. We'd be a stronger nation today if we had stuck with it. Members of Trump's Reculus Commission could learn a thing or two from him as well. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, for that. And thank you, too, for the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, who over there in America are fighting the battle. But we are doing it here, of course, at 3CR. In Australia. Now we go to Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools, who has been very busy in the last couple of weeks with his facts and figures. And here in Australia, when it comes to funding, you certainly find out where the state and church are not separate, because the public schools are underfunded and the private schools are overfunded. And the new schools agreements show that public schools will remain underfunded even up to 2034. Over to Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. New schools agreements show public schools will remain underfunded in 2034. And this was written by Trevor Cobold and published by Save Our Schools on October the 4th. The claim by the Prime Minister, Premiers and their Education Ministers that public schools will be fully funded by 2034 is a blatant lie. The new school funding agreements between the Commonwealth and the states are not on the path to full funding, as government media releases say. Despite a substantial and very welcome boost in funding, public schools will remain underfunded in 2034, 23 years after the Gonski report recommended full funding. Public schools will remain massively underfunded in each year until 2034. It is a shameful neglect of the challenges facing public schools and the learning needs of disadvantaged students, the large majority of whom attend public schools. In 2034, public schools in all states and the Northern Territory, 2029, will be funded at less than 100% of their schooling resource standard, SRS. The estimated SRS funding shares are New South Wales 96.2%, Queensland 97.6%, South Australia 98.6%, Western Australia 97.8%, Tasmania 97.7%, ACT 106%, Northern Territory 95.8%, and that last one by 2029. The Victorian agreement is not yet published, and it is not clear whether an agreement has even been signed yet. The underfunding is estimated at $1.7 billion in 2034, and the loss is highly likely to be over $2 billion once Victoria finally signs up. The underfunding estimates are New South Wales, $888 million, Queensland, $425 million, South Australia, $120 million, Western Australia, $192 million, Tasmania, $37 million, and the Northern Territory, $53 million. And again, that last figure refers to a 2029 figure, unlike the rest, 2034. Public schools will be heavily underfunded in each year until 2034. The cumulative underfunding is estimated at a massive $34.6 billion. Public schools suffered massive losses also under the Morrison government agreements. There are several reasons for the continuing underfunding. First, the Commonwealth increase in its funding share for public schools from 20% to 25% of their SRS is only gradually phased in and is heavily backloaded until the last 5 years in New South Wales, Queensland and South Australia. By 2029, it will have increased by only 0.5 of a percentage point in Queensland, by 1.3 percentage point in New South Wales and by 1.25 points in South Australia. Second, the 4% allowance that allows the states to claim capital depreciation as part of their share of funding public schools will not be fully removed until 2034. And the reductions are mainly in the last 5 years. Capital depreciation is specifically excluded from how the SRS is calculated, and its inclusion in state SRS shares defrauds public schools of their rightful funding. In New South Wales, Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania, this allowance will be reduced by only 1 percentage point to 3% between 2024 and 29. In Queensland, it will remain at 4% until 2028 and at 3.98% in 2029. Third, the states can still claim expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools that are specifically excluded from how the SRS is calculated. These allowances defraud public schools of their rightful funding. They can continue to claim expenditure on regulatory authorities such as curriculum and standards bodies as it relates to public schools. The Tasmanian and Northern Territory agreements even include expenditure claims for additional regulatory bodies not in the previous agreements. The states can claim a new separate allowance for expenditure on school transport for public school students as part of their share of funding the SRS of public schools. New South Wales and Queensland can claim up to 1.8% of the SRS. Western Australia and Tasmania can claim up to 1.5%. South Australia can claim 1.07% for school transport and 0.73% for mid-year student intake. The agreements admit these allowances are a non-standard inclusion. This is a remarkable admission by governments that these allowances defraud public schools of eligible SRS funding. The Western Australian Agreement allows the government to double dip by claiming an allowance for preschool expenditure and regulatory activity by the Department of Education as part of its share of funding public schools. These items are already included in how the SRS is calculated for Western Australian public schools. The continuing allowance to claim expenditure on regulatory authorities and the new allowances for school transport account for the underfunding of public schools of $1.7 billion in 2034. The biggest losses are for public schools in New South Wales and Queensland, $888 million and $425 million respectively. This funding loss from the non-SRS allowances is only slightly less than the $1.8 billion loss from them in 2024. The backloading of the Commonwealth funding increases and the reduction of the 4% allowances to the last 5 years of the 10-year agreements creates two significant dangers. First, it could compromise the achievement of the equity targets set for 2030 in the Better and Fairer School Funding Heads of Agreement, which sets equity targets for 2030. While these targets are too weak to make Australian school education fairer, the smaller funding increase in the first 5 years of the agreements may not be sufficient to achieve even these weak equity targets. A second danger is that the long phase-in period makes the agreements hostage to changes of government at the federal and state levels, just as the delayed funding increases under the Gillard-Gonski funding model allowed the Abbott government to abrogate its infamous pre-election unity ticket with the Rudd government. The new agreements unfairly discriminate against public schools by allowing governments to claim non-SRS expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools, but not for their share of funding private schools. Private schools are also subject to regulation, and private school students are eligible for school transport subsidies in all states. The state and Northern Territory agreements do not allow the governments to claim regulatory and school transport expenditure as it relates to private schools to be included as part of the share of funding these schools. Discriminatory defrauding of public schools provides another resource advantage for private schools. The agreements must be revised to give public schools better and fairer funding. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. State governments should remove the existing 4% allowance for non-SRS expenditure by 2029 and immediately remove new non-SRS expenditure claims as part of public school funding. Back to you, Jane.
Thank you, Andy. Let's hope that these facts and figures make the mainstream press. But even if they don't, you can always say that you heard it here first on 3CR. So we'll have a bit of a break now and we'll come back with a very interesting article from the Sydney Morning Herald.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, good afternoon, listeners. We hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program, because Sorrel is going to inform us about a rather distasteful fact. The far right Christian nationalists aren't just in America, they're here in Australia too. So, and they're teaching students at a Sydney college. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. This article is written by Patrick Begley and is entitled "The Far Right Figures Teaching Students at a Sydney College." Stephen McGinnery and Stephen Shavura both teach at Campion, a well-connected college in Sydney's West that promises undergraduates a vibrant campus, Catholic values, and a focus on the classics. The pair also promote white nationalism. Following questions from this masthead, Campion College is now investigating the academics who argue that Australia's Anglo-European culture is under existential threat. McKeony, the Dean of Studies, gave a speech this month saying Australia must one day form new political parties dedicated to the interests of our people, meaning white Australians. A former deputy head of the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, McKeony has also argued the white Australia policy did not go far enough, and that white Australians may need to live in separate neighbourhoods as a form of tactical retreat. Shavura, a senior lecturer in history, has launched an all-male club to celebrate Anglo-Celtic culture and deter leftist thugs from interfering with pro-Australia rallies. Both staff members have praised Enoch Powell, the British MP sacked from the Shadow Cabinet in 1968 after delivering his anti-immigration Rivers of Blood speech. I was not aware of the vast majority of the rhetoric or other things that you have brought to my attention, Campion College President Paul Morrissey said. They will be thoroughly investigated. All people, no matter their background, race or religion, are made to feel welcome at the college. Campion, which admits only about 50 students a year, has powerful connection with politics and the media. Board directors include former Liberal Federal Minister Zed Segea and a former union power broker Joe De Bruin. Several News Corp commentators and senior journalists have been appointed as honorary fellows. Former Liberal Prime Minister Tony Abbott has attended several events at the Toongabie campus, which has a library named after Australia's richest person, mining magnate Gina Rinehart. In 2021, the New South Wales and federal governments committed $5 million each to the college's Building Works program. McKeony, a poetry specialist and associate professor of literature, told a podcast this year that the white Australia policy was commonsensical. On X, he said it should have been enshrined in the constitution. In another post, McKeony suggested, without providing supporting evidence, that a rise in some forms of violence was linked to the decline of white Australians as a demographic. He has argued that recklessly throwing together different cultures and races has led to disaster in Western countries, including Australia, and that young Australians had to learn ad nauseam about Aboriginals, Jews, etc. He has questioned whether Greeks, Jews, Chinese, and Indians in Australia would remain loyal in the event of a war with their homelands, and suggested dual citizens be given financial incentives to leave the country. On August 31st, McKeony was among the speakers at the March for Australia rally in Sydney, one of several anti-immigration events held across the country. Wearing a suit jacket and sunglasses, he spoke of an unacceptable and radical transformation of Australia's racial and cultural character. He said that descendants of immigrants from the British Isles and Europe had formed a new Australian ethnicity, a people bound together by the crimson thread of blood. He said he wished well to those who lacked this ancestry to the extent that they recognised our claim on this continent. The speech was reproduced in full by The Noticer, an Australian platform that publishes articles on crime, emphasising the perpetrator's racial heritage, as well as opinion pieces by far-right figures. The Noticer described McInerney as a Sydney writer and a former director of the Ramsey Centre, but made no mention of his role at Campion. Earlier this month, he spoke at a conference held by the British Australian Community, another group dedicated to the interests of the Anglo-Celtic Australians, alongside his Campion College colleague, Stephen Shavura. A lecturer in European and Australian history, Shavura told the audience that the country should prefer an immigrant called David Smith to another called Mohammed Jihad, where the latter was a law-abiding, tax-paying, English-speaking Muslim. Shavura is also busy recruiting for a new group called Australia's Sons, which he hopes will swell to become a standing force of hundreds of thousands of men defending Anglo-Celtic heritage. According to a post on X earlier this month, the group would oppose multiculturalism and mass immigration, with a focus on education, fitness, camping, and the hosting of friendly fights. It would also provide a security presence at events like the March for Australia rallies, which Shavura promoted online. Leftist thugs will fear it. Haters of Australia will fear it. Anti-Australian politicians will fear it, the Sky News and Spectator commentator posted. No Nazis would be allowed, he said. But according to the group's social media chat, membership is primarily for Anglo-Celtic Europeans and their descendants. On X, Shavura has described multiculturalism as a cancer and a poison. He has also reposted content from racist accounts, including a message on X that described Indian people as a dangerous and subversive foreign fifth column in Western societies. In response to written questions, Shavura had said he would never knowingly repost genuinely racist content and did not mix in neo-Nazi circles and did not discuss his personal views in his classes. I would invite anyone to find any student I've taught over the past nearly 25 years who would accuse me of racism in any of my past behaviour or teaching, he said. My conscience is completely clear of that accusation. Shavura said he would not describe himself as a white nationalist or anti-immigrant, but repeated his desire for Anglo-Celtic Australians and Europeans to become once more a supermajority. I generally try to avoid the term white because it's purely racial, and I'm also concerned with culture, not to mention the fact that it's a term used by a lot of people I don't particularly want to be associated with, he said. Morrissey, the college president, said he was unable to comment on whether Shavura and McInerney would remain in their roles during the investigation. Back over to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Sol, for that very interesting information. And it's great, actually, that the Sydney Morning Herald is letting us know about these things. But there's some good news from up there in Sydney too. And there's the question of TAFE teachers and others being underpaid, and a very, very active teachers union up there, the New South Wales Teachers Federation, have always led Australia in being very active. You can tell, can't you, that I come from Sydney originally. But they do seem to still be keeping up that tradition. And here's another article from them. A press release, have you been underpaid too?
Thanks, Jean. Have you been underpaid too? This is a New South Wales Teachers Federation press release from the 18th of September. New South Wales Teachers Federation TAFE members have won more than $300,000 of back pay in the last 4 months, thanks to the New South Wales Teachers Federation's work to resolve issues concerning significant underpayments under previous TAFE New South Wales management. TAFE organiser Melissa O'Mara said the victory highlighted the importance of federation membership to effectively enforce, protect and improve our working conditions and entitlements through collective strength. We spend so much time working through these cases, and so many people think that because they work in the public sector, their pay can't be wrong. Well, I can tell you that wage theft, unintentional or not, is rife. These underpayments were primarily the result of previous TAFE New South Wales management's failure to fulfil entitlements for related duties and salary progression. Despite strong opposition from TAFE management at the time, Federation members won the case for payment of related duties for TAFE teachers 2 decades ago, when the New South Wales Industrial Relations Commission recognised the inequities in pay and conditions between part-time and casual teachers compared to those who were permanent. Since then, the TAFE Enterprise Agreement has been very clear about the entitlement of part-time and casual teachers to payment for related duties. It is not at the discretion of heads of skills teams, head teachers, band 3 or section head teachers to deny payment of related duties or any other entitlement. If TAFE members believe they have been underpaid, they should contact the New South Wales Teachers Federation on 1300 654 369. Melissa, along with Ben Parsons, will be hosting a workshop at the new activist conference aimed at TAFE teachers who would like to build union power and fight for better pay and conditions. We look forward to continuing our work with the current TAFE management to foster a flourishing and supportive TAFE system. And back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. And of course, if anybody knows about being an activist, a union activist, then that's Andy. But let's have a bit of a break now, shall we?
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855 AM digital and 3cr.org.au.
For 3 years, teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions, and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of a government funded primary school education and of a government-funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit! Our education is not for profit! You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
Yes, well, we hope that you're still listening to The Dogs program, because Jeff's now going to take us over to New Orleans and what happened after Katrina. So over to Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to talk about the United States as we normally do. A couple of good articles here, mainly about the imbalance between public education and private education that has grown and grown in the States, especially disadvantaging lower socioeconomic groups. But this one is from Nancy Bailey's education website. Nancy Bailey's article was reposted in the Network for Public Education, so I'm just giving them a shout-out. This article dates from the 25th of September, 25, and it says, it's called Breaking Up Public Schools Dangerously Divided the Nation. And she begins with a quote from Nelson Mandela. No one is born hating another person. People have to learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. That's Nelson Mandela. And she writes, Nancy writes, free public schools for America's children should unite us. When children learn to appreciate others who are unlike themselves or worship differently and form friendships, they develop deeper understanding and respect for differences and genuinely care for one another. Chances are they'll grow into adults who value others. We're supposed to be that country, a welcoming home for all, honouring culturally rich differences, a melting pot of democratic values reflected in America's public schools. This socialisation process involves embracing societal changes, ideas and innovations that drive progress for the world to emulate. America can only be great when its people care all about its children. But the nation is more divisive than ever, largely because over the years, Americans have allowed the breakdown of public education by those from both parties who wish to privatise schools. And in segregation, 1954, there was a case called Brown versus Board of Education that brought challenges. Black teachers and administrators lost jobs when white school staff poured into black schools. Attempts to integrate schools were met with controversy. Urban and rural schools struggled. Serious attempts to integrate public schools were often met with resistance from wealthy oligarchs working to undermine progress. In 2007, parents involved in community schools versus Seattle School District No. 1, a court case, ended school assignment policies based on racial classifications, bringing about resegregation. It's challenging to understand separation of church and state, the religious diversity, Americans with a variety of beliefs. Foisting one's own religion into a public school jeopardises all religions. By removing the government's ability to give preferential treatment to one religion or religion in general, the separation of church and state promotes religious pluralism. It allows all Americans to practice their deeply held beliefs in private and public. Here's a rundown of legal decisions surrounding schools and religion showing permissible religious actions in public schools. Oh, sorry, that is a link to a list of those things. Children from immigrant families, including those undocumented, have a constitutional right to attend school. Helping children communicate, English language learning, while not disparaging students in their native language, has been valued in public schools for many years. The high school where I worked included students in the community united in celebrating multicultural differences. This is the norm to build upon. Instead, the current climate for children of immigrants is dangerous. Schools may be a fearful place. America has lost its moral compass. The National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators describes problems students face attempting to further their education, including student debt, affecting a student's life for years. Students from lower economic backgrounds could only afford 1-5% of colleges. While career and technical career training can lead to good jobs for many students, colleges become unattainable, which also hurts the economy. A Georgetown University report describes the skills shortage facing America, including the following professional careers: managers, teachers, nurses, accountants and auditors, engineers, attorneys and physicians. Carers that don't require college will be in demand are drivers, sales workers, truck drivers and construction workers. How many young adults become alienated, believing only elitists get college? The resistance to desegregation, the promotion of unproven private and parochial schools, evolved into a drive for segregated charter schools and vouchers. The focus could have lifted alternative schools within school districts run by creative educators incubating new ideas. These schools already existed and were equally evaluated and run as true public schools by educators, the professionals. Instead, charter schools have become an industry running rampant, often unsuccessfully, by novices who get rich off traditional public schools. Carol Burris for The Progressive recently described the accelerated closing of these schools. Separate from traditional public schools, they've created a two school systems where neither provides the best that education could be and which separates students. Vouchers promoted initially to help low-income students attend better schools, a promise rarely realised, are freely given to wealthy parents with few restrictions. Many parents supplement their students' attendance to elite private schools. Voucher funds are also used for items that have little to do with formal instruction. In Florida, Welsh 2 investigates found more than 8,400 students had theme park tickets reimbursements paid or approved for this school year. Most of them, nearly 6,000 of them, have personalised education plans, scholarships for homeschooling as opposed to scholarships for a private school. They also buy big screen TVs. Civics, a policy brief from Sandra Day O'Connor Institute for American Democracy, describes civics instruction's decline, partly due to the overemphasis of high-stakes standardised testing. Liberal Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor recently spoke about civics instruction, questioning whether Americans understand the importance of democracy or the difference between a president and a king. The Trump administration, with Education Secretary Linda McMahon, is pushing America 250 Civics Coalition. It seems tied to religion and will likely promote a sanitised history, as we've seen this administration attack diversity and inclusion and make light of, even eliminate, references to slavery. The initiative includes controversial groups like Centre for Education Reform, American Legislative Exchange Council, Heritage Foundation, Mums for Liberty, Turning Point USA and PragerU, and many more. We've done stories on a lot of those, just as an aside. High-stakes standardised tests hurt America's students, now adults. How many believe based on one test they failed? Such tests narrowed the curriculum, were culturally biased and left teachers little recourse to address strengths in students. A study by the Russell Sage Foundation found that variation in third grade achievement and learning rates is considerable among rural districts, indicating that rates of early and middle childhood education opportunity are not evenly distributed throughout rural America. Both parties have been complicit in overtesting, and it has done irreparable harm in separating students into those who feel successful and those who see themselves as failures. Think of how private schools could have been, how professional teachers could have lifted students without having to fight so hard against the test taking and the drive to close the public schools. Well-prepared teachers with university degrees in the areas they teach ensure that students become knowledgeable in what they need to further their education or for careers to live productive adult lives. Throughout the years, we've seen attacks on the teaching profession, on education preparation schools. Alternative programs like Teach for America, where young college graduates become classroom teachers with only 5 weeks of training, are insufficient. Sometimes these individuals become education leaders without being prepared. Non-profits like Dean for Impact, New Leaders for New Schools and other AstroTurf groups undermine a true teaching profession. Teachers bring students together. This country is hugely investing in AI despite confusion and concern over its outcomes. Technology in public schools thus far has failed to lift American students. Teachers bring students together, help them better understand subjects, learn together and simulate conversations to provide children with insight of others. It's time to focus more on helping teachers to teach their students. Recess. Recess for children may seem insignificant. In the 90s, public schools began eliminating school recess. However, children getting to play freely under adult supervision in school is a mighty way to help them understand others. It's one of the best ways children socialise. Not only does it involve socialisation, but it's a break from academics and refreshes the children to be able to do their schoolwork. We have to wonder what children have missed when it comes to learning how to relate with one another having been denied recess. Americans had the chance and still can to unite to create a public education system that pulls the nation together. A country that focuses on compassion for others is based on finding the will to come together and lift all America's children working on society's challenges for the world to see. That's the end of the article. I think it's just a really nice summary of why public education is so important at knitting society together. Now, the next story comes from New Orleans. Now, if you've ever had the fortunate opportunity of seeing the HBO series Tremé, you'll know how much they struggled after the impact of Hurricane Katrina and in 2005. And this article is about that and the impact of that, that catastrophe has had on the city's education system. This is from the Our Schools website. It's written by Elizabeth K. Jeffers, PhD. She's an assistant professor at University of New Orleans, and Ashana Bigard, who's a director of Amplify Justice and Educational Advocate. And this article appeared in Our Schools, which is an online blog supporting public education. This article dates from the 7th of October. And the article is titled, 20 Years After Katrina, the city's all-charter school system is failing many families. I may have to abbreviate this. This is quite a long article. Despite claims of reform advocates of achieving success, black children and parents continue to endure punitive, impersonal and undemocratic systems. Now, it begins. To mark the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's devastation of New Orleans, numerous articles and opinion pieces have appeared in prominent media outlets touting the supposed improvement of the city's public school system since the storm. Katrina's immediate aftermath saw the state of Louisiana disempower the democratically elected school board by taking over the management of 107 out of 128 schools. This led to the termination of 7,600, mainly black and women, teachers, paraprofessionals, cafeteria workers, clerical workers, principals and other permanent employees, and the eventual conversion of all the city's public schools into privately managed charters. A Washington Post column, never seen before, How Katrina Set Off an Education Revolution, by British journalist Ian Birrell, proclaimed the transformation a miracle. Another opinion piece in the 74, The Inconvenient Success of New Orleans Schools, by Ravi Gupta, the founder and former CEO of the Charter School Network, stated that the New Orleans school system shaped by Katrina was a model that should be theoretically appealed to both sides of America's education debates. It delivered the academic results that reformers promised while addressing the equity and community concerns that critics raised. As proof of their arguments, both authors pointed to a June 2025 report, The New Orleans Post-Katrina Reform School Reforms 20 Years of Lessons, by Douglas Harris and Jamie M. Carroll of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. Pulling from the data presented in that study, Birrell said the case for declaring New Orleans-style education reform a remarkable success is pretty definitive, and Gupta called this supposed success an unequivocal conclusion. As a long-time youth advocate and community leader and an assistant professor at the University of New Orleans, who was a public school teacher in the city, we invite you to consider whether this data alone proves that New Orleans public schools and the families they serve are better off after 20 years of reform. Although Gupta warns against falling into the tyranny of the anecdote when reporting on fraught education debates like those over the meaning of the New Orleans reforms, we'd like to tell you about Rio, whose last name has been withheld for privacy reasons. Rio attended 12 different schools in New Orleans, many of which were shut down suddenly before he finally graduated from a school that is now also closed. Rio's story is not atypical of the human cost to the New Orleans school system, where closures are a defining feature and evidence that the disaster Katrina wrought on the schools is still happening. Forced to traverse the fragmented charter system that has replaced the public school system of neighbourhood schools, New Orleans students are often traumatised by multiple school closures. Decades of research attest to the academic, emotional and economic harms that result from severing social connections with families, faculty and staff, and that has happened as a result of these schools closing and with one another. For instance, obtaining a job reference letter from a former teacher should be simple for students to do, but that task has become an obstacle course for many young adults from New Orleans, like Rio. Black Man Rising, a national group providing outreach and mentorship for black youth, had to intervene to help him to attain the letter that made the difference between being able to financially support himself and being just another addition to the statistics of black youth who are unemployed and incarcerated. Rio's story illustrates a central paradox of the New Orleans system. Black families and communities continue to be severed and displaced as a result of failed leadership at the federal, local and state levels. While the storm may be over, the disaster continues. On the other hand, white children in New Orleans rarely experience school closures. I'm going to leave the article there, but I would encourage you to have a look at it. It's a long article, and it does show that despite touting to the contrary by people who stand to make money out of it, The school charter system in New Orleans has actually been an unmitigated disaster for the students themselves. They may look good on paper, but these private schools open up and close down again, pocketing large amounts, millions of dollars of public funds through via the voucher system. And this rort is being touted by leaders on both sides who probably take money from the oligarchs who are in charge of these private school systems. Anyway, with that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of Dogs and wish you a very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. And now we have a very interesting article from The Educator. Teachers are expected to be many things, aren't they? In loco parentis, teachers actually teaching all sorts of things. They have to be experts on everything. And the one thing they're also expected to be expert on are children with disabilities these days, and also children who are just in pain. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. Teachers Left in the Dark on Managing Student Pain, a study. This was published in The Educator on the 3rd of October. 1 in 5 children across Australia lives with chronic pain, and while their suffering often goes unseen, its impact can echo through every corner of the classroom. From migraines and juvenile arthritis to ongoing stomach pain, students are grappling with more than just physical symptoms. For teachers, this means juggling lesson plans with fatigue, concentration issues, emotional distress, and the need to accommodate frequent breaks. But new research reveals it's not just students feeling the weight of these conditions, teachers are struggling too. A study led by physiotherapist and UTS PhD student Rebecca Fechner has shed light on the hidden pressures educators face as they try to support students with chronic pain. The findings show that while awareness around student pain is growing, many teachers feel unprepared and emotionally drained as they try to meet their students' needs with little guidance or support. Teachers are deeply committed to their students' well-being, said Ms. Fechner, who will graduate with her PhD in October. But when it comes to pain, they're often left to navigate complex situations without training or guidance, relying on instinct and personal experience. Teachers feel helpless. Recently published in Pediatric and Neonatal Pain, the study involved interviews with 11 teachers across primary and secondary schools. It found that educators frequently felt helpless, emotionally drained, and unsupported when trying to respond to student pain, particularly when symptoms are medically unexplained. One teacher said, "I can only do what I can do based on my experience," noting that managing student pain is common, but not something she has ever been taught. Others spoke of sacrificing their own well-being to support students, working through lunch breaks or losing sleep over whether they had responded appropriately. "I wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes being like, did I say that thing right? Did I do that thing right?" said one participant. "I just question whether or not I had done the right thing." The research identifies 3 key areas where pain science education can create meaningful change for both teachers and students. Teacher-student relationships. Because pain is a social experience, relationships can positively change pain outcomes. Teachers already possess empathy and communication skills that can be harnessed with targeted training. School culture and policy. A collective understanding of the biopsychosocial nature of pain can optimise existing inclusive policies and supportive environments in schools. Societal beliefs. Misconceptions about pain, such as the idea that children exaggerate or that pain must be visible, need to be addressed through pain science education. Teachers want to help, says Fechner, but they need time, training and support. We must equip them with knowledge about pain science and a framework to respond to their students with curiosity and validation. Pain awareness training needed. The study calls for pain awareness to be integrated into teacher training, school policy and public health initiatives, recognising pain as a legitimate barrier to learning and empowering teachers to be part of the solution. Pain is complex, but our response doesn't have to be, says Fechner. With empathy, education and collaboration, we can make schools safer and more supportive for every student and every teacher. Building on the findings of this study, Fechner's PhD research explores how pain science can be embedded into the school curriculum through a teacher-led approach. In collaboration with 2 pilot schools in Queensland and New South Wales, she has co-designed Australia's first teacher-led pain science education program for teachers and students. Teachers were provided with foundational content about how the nervous system works and the factors that influence pain, and were supported to integrate it into subjects like health and science. The program also encouraged discussion of the social aspects of pain and helping students learn how to support peers. By placing teachers at the centre of the initiative, the program aims to improve health literacy and reshape how school communities understand and respond to chronic pain. Fechner said it's not just about teaching children. By educating teachers, we empower them to lead and inspire a new generation of students with the skills to better understand and support those in pain. Sounds like a fantastic project. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you so much about that. Very interesting indeed. But now we come to the best part of our program, our great state school. And I'd like to say, public education is about all the children. Even if they're children in a very, very small rural community where there aren't many children, they're still, and we're going to now tell you about it, a school for even those communities. And they're lovely schools. They're very intimate and they're community schools and they're very happy places for children to grow up in. Let's hear about our great state school of the week.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School
great
of the
school.
Week. Great state schools.
State schools.
Schools.
School
are
of
great
the week.
Schools.
School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Locksport Primary School. And this is the principal's report. Locksport Primary School is a small school located in the picturesque township of Locksport. Situated between 90 Mile Beach and the Gippsland Lakes, we are blessed with abundant wildlife, beautiful scenery, and glorious weather. We are able to offer small class sizes, and this means students have more opportunities to work with a teacher in a one-to-one or small group capacity as we cater for mixed abilities and grade levels. We currently operate two classrooms and also have a multi-purpose building that houses our library and an area we can use for art and cooking classes. Our library area is regularly utilised by our community playgroup, special activities for students, and as a meeting room for staff. We provide a number of extracurricular activities that include music, cooking, gardening, swimming, art and sport for students to participate in at the school. We also provide our students with opportunities to participate in sport and activities such as swimming carnival, cross country, coach approach winter sports program, athletics, camps, leadership conferences and transition days within our rural cluster of schools. Locksport Primary School values include respect, resilience, responsibility and safety. Respect, being nice and kind to others, yourself and the school. Resilience, having a go and doing your best and aiming to beat your personal best. Responsible, for your own space, belongings, school property and always doing the right thing. Safety, keeping yourself and others safe from getting hurt and using equipment correctly. Values are an integral way of life in our school. We are continuously working to ensure that we understand what our team values and how we can live them in order to make our team the best it can be. Our staff are united and committed to providing all students with ample opportunities to learn and grow in a safe, happy and engaging environment. Locksport Primary School is a great place to learn, play and make friends. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The current enrolment is 14. The ICSEA value, well below average at 884, representative of a small rural community. In the upper 25% of parental income are zero students. The second level of parental income is 4% of students. 24% of students have parents in the third quartile, that is below 50% of parental incomes, and the lowest quartile of parental incomes account for 72% of students, with 10% speaking a language other than English and 14% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $151,000 and Victorian Government $476,000. Private fees and contributions add another $818 and other private contributions $15,675. That works out per student $42,896 and the capital $632,000 over 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Locksport Primary School and the teachers and the parents and the children up there doing such a lovely job. But our time has gone. If you want to find out more about the dogs, you can. You can go to our website at www.adogs.info. And if you want to hear our previous programs, you can go to the 3CR website and listen to the podcast. But from our wonderful producer, Dale, and from Andy, who does such a wonderful work reading all our stuff for us, and from Sorrel and from Jeff and from myself, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.